Welcome to the Modern Carnivore Podcast, a guide for those interested in hearing more about hunting, fishing, and other paths to eating more responsibly. Now, here's your host, Mark Norquist.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode 10 of the Modern Carnivore Podcast. Today, I am joined by John Whipfley and Jamie Carlson. Jamie, you are probably familiar with as he is a regular contributor on Modern Carnivore. And if you haven't checked out a couple of his recent recipes, I highly recommend it. One of them is a nettle pasta. And if you think about stinging nettles, they're generally something that you want to avoid when you're in the outdoors, because obviously they can create a sting irritation to your skin. But Jamie shares with everyone a recipe for turning these wild weeds into this beautiful green pasta, which I think is pretty fascinating. Another recipe he recently did was a venison heart tartare. If you have not eaten heart from a large ungulate like a deer, you're missing out. The tartare recipe is essentially a way to prepare it raw. And I've had heart with Jamie before, and I know he knows how to prepare it very well. And so I think you would find that recipe fascinating. So I'm also joined today by John Whipfley. John is a new guest on the Modern Carnivore Podcast. John and I got to know each other several years ago when he was an executive chef developing menus for a major barbecue chain. And I knew at that time, given his background, that he was going to do a lot of amazing things. He was just getting ready to finish up a wild game cookbook called Venison, which we have talked about on Modern Carnivore before. And he has a forthcoming cookbook here in the summer of 2019, early summer, that is called Fish. And it is a comprehensive freshwater fish cookbook. And we talk about that today. John's got a really great background. He is a graduate of the French Culinary Institute in New York. He launched a few years ago the Minnesota Spoon, which was a way to share barbecue in the North. And his regular gig now is he created a food truck called Animalis Barbecue, which is in North Minneapolis, where it sits outside of Abel Seed House, which is a phenomenal brewery in the North Loop area of Minneapolis. So if you are in the area, please go check it out. Check out the food truck. Check out Abel Seed House. And most importantly, check out John's fish cookbook when it comes out here in the next few weeks. Enjoy the podcast. Okay, we are at Abel Seed House in North Loop area of Minneapolis. I am joined today by a couple guys here. Why don't you introduce yourselves?
I am John Whipfley, owner of Animalis Barbecue Company, which is right outside Abel Brewing, 4 days a week. And I also wrote the venison cookbook that's sitting next to you, and have an upcoming fish cookbook that releases on May 15th.
There you go. We're done with the podcast.
There you go. Let's drink some beer.
Sounds good. We do have good beer sitting in front of us.
Yes, we do.
How about you?
I'm Jamie Carlson. I'm a contributor to Modern Carnivore and here to provide entertainment.
As always. So, a little bit noisy here in the brewery, but these guys were kind enough to let us come in here on the day when it is closed. And as you mentioned, John, we are sitting about 20 yards from your food truck. And, you know, why don't you just, let's start with that. Explain a little bit about the food truck.
Yeah, so, you know, planning for this food truck went back probably a year and a half now, more than that, actually. And we finally got it launched last August, end of summer, so we missed the busy season. We just went through our first winter. I think we closed only for 2 or 3 days throughout that terrible winter we just had, so it was a long winter to be working in a food truck.
And I do notice you're in flip-flops today.
Yeah, man.
And we're supposed to get 15 inches of snow on Thursday.
That's stupid. I can't. I'm over it. Yeah, so we finally got the barbecue food truck up and running. We just smoke fresh meats 4 days a week, serve them right over the smoker kind of deal, and we smoke meat until we run out, and that's how it works.
And we are the reason you're grunting is we do have somebody else here with us today, and who is that?
That is my Weimaraner Hank, who's usually fairly well behaved, but the moment you stop paying attention to him, he does stuff like this.
He's a big boy.
He is a big boy.
So, I have had your barbecue before, but before you had this truck, and
yep.
So I'm looking forward to trying it out. You got some crazy items on the menu there that look really good, and I know your tagline on your Instagram account is stretchy pants recommended, which I like that. But you got what, the meat tornado? Is that one of your items?
Yeah, that's a 1 day a week item, so that's a Sunday only item. And that thing, I mean, just honestly, it just started as a joke, and so the way that came up is we take our ribs. Our ribs have 12 bones in them. We take the last two bones off of each rib, smoke those, and then take the meat off of it. And then we turn that meat into a sandwich because it eats better after it's picked. And instead of trying to eat it off the bone where it can get kind of fatty down there. And so we were trying to figure out a way to use that meat. That was still a quality way to use it. And then I was watching Parks and Rec one night, and Ron Swanson has a meat tornado line. And we just decided to run it. And then people like recognize the reference, and then Instagram caught onto it, and we haven't been able to not run it since then. So Sundays, start selling it at noon. We do about 40 a week, and once they're gone, they're gone.
So how often are you selling out of product?
Summer months, we sell out pretty much every day we open right now. We sell out of our smoked meats. The way we do it is we load the smoker up, we fill it with pork belly ribs, and sausage, and for example, we'll load it once on a Saturday at 7:30 in the morning, and then once at noon, and we'll sell out the first round by 4:30, and then we pull out the second round and usually sell it out by 8. But then there's some other items like tacos and bowls you can get later on into the evening.
Cool. So, the main purpose of our conversation today is talk about your forthcoming cookbook. Called Fish, correct?
Yep, you got it.
But let's step back a little bit first and talk a little bit about you and your background, because we've talked about having you on the podcast for a long time.
Yeah, a while now.
And it was back before venison when we first started talking about some different things. When did you start hunting and fishing? Did you grow up with it? Did you learn it later on?
Yeah, so my family, I grew up in a hunting and kind of an outdoors family. And so I was always around it when I was a kid. And it was a part of just our daily, I grew up in the middle of Wisconsin. So that's nothing uncommon. It was just a part of the day-to-day sort of operation. And then I took part in it to a small degree when I was younger and through high school. And then when I left Wausau, Wisconsin to move on to go cook, I really didn't take part in hunting for like a 10-year span. I was more focused on other outdoor activities, camping, biking, hiking, snowboarding, all that stuff. And then when I moved back to the Midwest when I was, I guess I would have been 26 or 27, it just naturally fell into place as the thing to do in the outdoors. I have a huge circle of friends who hunt, fish, and it's just the best, it's just the best activity you can do in the Midwest in this region. So when I moved back here, immediately started just participating in those activities again. And then it just kind of fell in line with cooking. Obviously, as a byproduct of hunting, you end up with some meat occasionally, if you're lucky. And now we're here.
Very cool. So when you were growing up in Wisconsin, did you deer hunt?
I didn't deer hunt until my 20s. I would go to deer camp and, hang out with the guys and drink beer.
Yeah.
But it was mainly birds and fishing.
Okay, cool.
When you were younger, the venison, the game, whatever you had, was it any good?
you know, it's hard to say.
Yeah, I know.
But one thing I do remember is eating a lot of lead, and I didn't like that experience.
Yeah.
I think it's a good ingredient.
So
a little toothy.
Growing up, I'm actually surprised that I've actually enjoyed wild game anymore, because any deer that was shot was turned into summer sausage.
Yeah.
All of it. There was nothing left over.
Yeah.
And anything else that was shot was cooked until it died a second death. And the ducks that we'd get, the geese that we'd get, were dry and stringy. And at that age, you know, it'd take a glass of milk to get each bite down.
Yep.
So I was just curious if other people had similar experiences here in the Midwest.
I think there was a lot of crock pots involved.
Yes. And cream of mushroom soup.
Yes. Yeah, and that's kind of my memory of it. Okay. It definitely wasn't an elevated experience.
You know, for me, it was probably the worst preparation for game when I was a kid was ducks, where my grandmother's recipe that my dad would always follow was roasting them. I mean, we always plucked our ducks. We never would never skin our ducks. Always plucked them, no matter how small, little teal to large mallards. And then in an attempt to keep them moist, you know, you put two bacon strips across the top, you know, across, which did no good, really, in the end. I mean, I think it was, you know, you'd bake it for, oh, my gosh, I don't even know, hour and a half or whatever it would be.
But you had to eat two pieces of bacon.
Right. Exactly. Well, actually, they were never cooked that well. So, you know, and they would just get so dried out like that. I still remember when I was in my early 20s. First time I read a recipe on super high heat baking just with the duck and then serving it rare and going, oh my gosh, why haven't I been doing this my whole life?
You know? Yeah, no, I don't know if you've had similar experiences, but the first time that I took venison and cooked it rare and ate it, I was like,
what?
Your eyes
wait a minute.
Up.
Yeah.
You can do this?
Wait a minute. What happened to the hockey puck that I've been eating my entire life?
Right, exactly. So, John, when did you start cooking? I mean, did you as when you were younger and not like currently, but like going way back to the start of it, I mean, did you, and not even think about wild game, but did you start cooking at a young age, just regular meals, and or was it later on again?
Yeah, so I remember being a kid and trying to cook new things with my family. Like, I remember I would cook my brother mac and cheese out of a box, and I'd always try and make it better, which, you know, that's what we had in the pantry, so that's what I would do. And then I remember trying to make mashed potatoes for the first time for our Thanksgivings, and then and so that, I mean, I just kind of had it like intuitively. And then when I left high school, I started working in the kitchen immediately. And I was also in art school. And I wasn't very good at art school, but I excelled in the kitchen. So just ran with it from there.
Just different ingredients, still art.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, it's kind of the same. You kind of play with ingredients, and I don't know. There's a little more craft. Well, maybe not a little more craft. There's a faster end result to it, and
a better end result. I mean, I like looking at a piece of artwork on the wall, but I'd much rather eat it.
Yeah,
be able to
eat
the
that's
art.
What I'm looking for. So that was kind of, I mean, I started when I was a kid, growing up in central Wisconsin. You know, kind of, we didn't have a lot of diverse food options.
Did you put a lot of cheese on your food?
I think there was cheese in just about everything. There was a cheese in a pork chop somewhere in every meal. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Way to play to the stereotype, Mark.
Exactly. Hey, nothing wrong with cheese, man. I love cheese. So, I mean, but you were, you know, fast forward, I guess. You actually went to formal training for chefery, if you will, at the French Culinary Institute of New York, correct?
Yeah, that was a pretty good experience. Lived in New York for a couple years, 2-3 years, and went to the French Culinary Institute, which is a pretty fun experience. Our dean was Jacques Pepin, which was cool to be able to meet him a couple times. And he taught us how to make omelets, in like a big class one day, which seems minor, but it's a pretty cool thing. Mm-hmm. And then just the level of food production out there it's unreal. There's so many. I mean, there's tens of thousands of restaurants all in this little tiny area. So if you're not performing at a very high level, you're gonna go under. It was a pretty good experience just to learn how to execute at a high level. But that being said, 2.5-3 years there was kind of my max. I was maxed out and wanted to get back to the Midwest. And
were you in Manhattan, or where were you at? Or?
So I worked in Manhattan, and my school was in Soho, so it was right. I mean, it was right in the middle of everything. And then we lived in Brooklyn, right across the bridge. But it's all. I mean, it's all super dense. I mean, obviously, it's just. It's incredibly dense in the middle of Manhattan, or if you cross a bridge into Brooklyn. I mean, either way, there's not a lot of green space. There's not an easy route out of town.
Were you able to do any outdoor stuff, any hunting, fishing out there?
No, we did. You know, my life was fairly consumed with cooking, obviously, and learning that craft and that trade. But we did make it upstate once or twice when there was a week off, and that was about it. But no hunting or fishing, just hiking around, bebopping, that sort of thing.
So I think we should do a cooking event out in New York. You know, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, which we're all part of and connected to, has been doing some events out in New York and Manhattan as of late. It'd be fun to go out there. Todd Waldron, who's become a good friend, he's out upstate New York, but they're doing a lot of fun things out there, which is pretty cool for people living in this city, but being able to realize not too far away is some great opportunities to hunt and fish.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you get outside of New York and you go to upstate, and it's not too far away removed from what you see in Minnesota or Wisconsin. It's similar terrain, similar landscape, and it's beautiful country.
They've really been pushing the deer hunting out there, too.
Have they?
Apparently, they're just overrun with deer.
Hmm.
But it's also a very dense Lyme disease area. So they've been pushing the deer hunting out there, trying to get people to come out.
Those ticks.
Might be a good spot to go.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. Next podcast.
Yeah.
So you came back to Minnesota. You got your degree now. You worked at Bachelor Farmer, right?
Yeah, helped open that little space. Awesome restaurant. I don't know if you've been there, but they do some great food. They still have a high standard that they execute to perfectly. So that was another good experience. I got to work with Paul Berglund, who's just like this crazy. I mean, the way his brain and food work, it's just pretty great to watch. Learned a ton from that guy, and just learned how to you know, kind of operate in a kitchen that was, for lack of a better term, just booming at the time. We opened up, and then, you know, within a year, we were on the cover of New York Times Magazine, and everything just exploded. So trying to keep up with that curve while still, like, being innovative and doing new stuff was just a huge learning experience for me.
Hank.
Hank.
Why don't you climb into his lap?
This guy thinks he thinks he's a little tiny
lap
puppy.
Dog,
yet.
Little lap dog, exactly. So, what kind of food did you have on the menu at Bachelor Farmer when you were there?
So that was all Nordic food, or it was Nordic-esque. But you know, the real way we looked at it was like, if someone from that region lived in Minneapolis, what would they cook? So we would just take fresh ingredients that were locally raised, locally sourced. Locally grown, and then apply.
Right there's left leg. There we go.
Then apply, you know, techniques from that region to those foods. So like Gravlax was, you know, a huge one. Everyone loves that in Minnesota, and that Bachelor Farmer recipe or a similar one to it is in the new cookbook. That was our approach to food, and it worked really well for us. And I think we hit it at a time when that wasn't as popular as it is right now. Like, you know, you go back 10, well, I guess 8 years, and that kind of new American style of cooking wasn't as forward or wasn't as prevalent as it is right now. Now there's a ton of restaurants that do it, you know?
So one thing I ate at the Bachelor Farmer years ago sort of plays into what we're doing here. It was duck fat roasted beets with the grated Botarga.
Yeah.
Is there a freshwater version of Botarga that would be possible?
Probably.
Probably.
Off the top of my head, you know, that's a question I haven't really been asked.
You know, maybe the herring or something like that. Would that be possible?
We used to do a cured herring roe there. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the result of it, but I remember we were experimenting with it for a while. But I don't remember what we ended up doing with it.
Hmm.
As I was saying, so venison is a cookbook, your first cookbook, right?
Yep.
So this is a year, 2 years ago?
Yeah, it's probably about 2 years ago now.
Yeah.
Time flies, I guess.
So talk a little bit about it, because there's one recipe in here, I think I've tried more, but the first one, the venison neck split pea soup, that is the one I have marked, as you can see, with my little tag here on page 84.
Yeah.
And that was the one that stood out to me when you first came out with it. I'm like, that's the recipe I want to be doing first.
Yeah, that recipe, I mean, it's pretty simple, and it's just, you're basically just, you know, making a, making your flavoring a soup by simmering a venison neck for a really long time. And you could do that with a couple parts. I think a shoulder would work well, or anything. And this one, you know, we were trying to use the entire, we shot one deer for this book, or I shot one deer for this book, and then we just tried to use every part of the deer for different recipes. So that's kind of how that book was broken down, just how to use one entire deer and then fill up a cookbook with it. And that's the recipe we chose for that. But, you know, cooking stocks and things like that, it's just the foundation of, in my opinion, the foundation of good cooking. It's a nice roasted stock adds so much umami and so much depth to your soups. So doing that process, you just get a more well-rounded, balanced, really flavorful soup.
Absolutely. So, and the one thing I like that you did with this book, and I think you're doing with the new one too, is you really start, and this is great for people who are new to hunting and fishing, which is a lot of people who listen to the Modern Carnivore podcast. And so you go into the hunt itself and really the butchering, and then that leading into the different recipes. So maybe talk a little bit about that. Like what was the thinking behind that?
Yeah, so I think for me, you know, when I came back to the Midwest, I had a struggle. I don't know if it was a struggle, but it was a challenge to get back into hunting and fishing. You know, I didn't have a ton of gear. I was trying to learn a bunch of new stuff, and I kind of wanted people to see step by step how to get into it if you didn't grow up doing it, and if you don't have a bunch of guns that your dad gave you or whoever gave you, that there's a route to do it. And it's really not that difficult. It just takes time, and it takes, you know, a lot of patience, and it takes a lot of failure. But at the end of the day, it's kind of worth it. So when I wrote that book, I had that in mind where, you know, you got to start somewhere if you want to get into it. And it's something that's valuable in my life, and I think can offer a lot of value to people. So when we wrote that's kind of the reason we started from square one, and then took people through just step by step. This is how you break down a deer, and then this is how you use each individual muscle. That's kind of the.
I forget. Do you go into organs at all in here or not?
I think the only organ we went into was heart. And actually, no. There's a pate recipe for the liver, and then there's a heart recipe, and that's as far as we went.
Cool. Why deer? Why venison? As the focus.
That's a good question. I mean, it just kind of came about. We put out. You know, when the publishing company approached me, we went into 10, 15 different ideas of what the book should be. And then by the end of the day, we just narrowed it down to venison. It felt like something for me. I've butchered a ton of animals in my life, mainly pigs. but like the for me the butchery section was a huge part of it, showing people how to do that. I just have a lot of experience there, so that you know, butchering a deer and butchering a pig is pretty similar at the end of the day. So I thought that that I had a good opportunity to showcase that, and then venison just tastes good. And I think what you were talking about earlier too, there's a million ways to cook it poorly, and that's usually how it's done. Or I shouldn't say that. I'm like tearing down entire group of people. That's often how I've seen it done.
There's some reality to that.
I thought there was some opportunity to improve that process, is a good way to put it.
I don't think people think outside the box enough.
Yeah.
You know, we were raised on crock pots and cream of mushroom soup. And, you know, you grill it until it's dead. You season it with Lowry's seasoning salt. And that's what you do with your wild game.
Yep.
And I think growing up in that culture, everybody just assumes that's what you do.
Yeah.
And then it's supposed to taste good because you went out and hunted it and you did all this work for it. So then you eat it and you're like, yeah, it's the best thing ever. And then you feed it to my wife, who's never been near it before in her life. And she's like, what is wrong with you? This is terrible. But that's where you got to do things differently. Try different things.
That's exactly right. And there was just that huge opportunity, in the especially with the venison there. So we just approached that, and that's how the book came to be. Partially, you know, it's what I wanted to, but then there's a whole, like, marketing aspect to things, and it's what a publishing company sees can sell. So the combination of those two things, that's how we ended up.
Yeah, absolutely. What's your favorite recipe out of the book?
Oh, the heart recipe.
Yeah.
That thing. Heart is one of my favorite muscles.
Little fist bump of the guys going on here.
And I've cooked heart, you know, before I wrote this, years before I wrote this book, I've cooked venison heart. And I cooked it, like, someone told me, like, boil it for like 4 hours. And then, and I tried it. And it was
disgusting. Mountain Dew.
Exactly.
And then in this book, we basically clean it up a little bit, skewer it, and then cook it to medium rare. And you cook heart to medium rare, and it is just, it's one of the best. I think it's the best tasting part on the deer.
I think heart and tongue are two of the best parts that just get overlooked, and people, I think, have such a psychological barrier to. And I think if more people tried it, they'd understand how wonderful it is.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, not to go over it again, but it's probably been cooked so many times poorly for them that they don't want to give it another chance.
Well, there was a way you had to do things, and everybody did it that way, and that was the recipe that was passed down. I grew up in a family that the heart was never even a consideration.
Yep.
It was left in the field.
Left in the, yeah, gut pile, yeah.
And, you know, I've told all my friends, you know, save your hearts. If you're not going to eat them, just save them. I'll come get them.
Yep.
I've had 30 hearts in my damn freezer at points because everybody gives me a heart. So you get to play around with them.
Yeah.
And you do crazy things for fun, and you do weird things for no reason. You know, salt cure them, dry them, make a gig. Brajoule out of a heart, and it's delicious.
I think that's
great. So talk a little bit about Fish, the upcoming book that I'm not sure we'll probably when we'll get this podcast out, but I'm going to get it out, try to time it really well with your launch of it, so when people listen they can go out and order it.
And the opening of Fishing.
Yeah, there you go.
It's right after the opening of Fishing. It comes out, and then if you pre-order it, it's actually pre-ordering for like, I think it's like $17. So if you pre-order it, you get a discount.
Wow,
that's
great.
That's on Amazon. So
is that hardcover or softcover?
Hardcover.
Hardcover.
And
$17.
As soon as it releases, it'll go up to whatever the cover price is.
Yeah.
But it was a super fun book to write.
So it's similar to the venison book. You did it all around one deer. So this book is all around one fish?
Yeah, it's all it's all around frying walleyes. That's it.
600 ways of frying a walleye.
So it was a fun book to write. We got to do a little bit of traveling. You know, for the venison book, there wasn't a lot of travel involved. Fish book, we got to do a few fishing trips. I got to learn a lot about different fishing techniques. So that was like a fun aspect of it.
So stop right there, because that was going to be one of my questions. What's your favorite technique of fishing?
I'm a musky fisherman. That's that's what I like to do.
And so topwater fly, are you doing big bucktails? Are you throwing out plugs? Like, what do you like?
Rubbers and bucktails.
Okay.
And sometimes a topwater mix.
Okay.
So my core friend group, they just got attached to musky fishing a while ago. We used to like to fish for, like, you know, walleyes, panfish, all that stuff. But then musky fishing just took over. And then it naturally took over with me too, as it does with a lot of people. So it was a fun experience to go out and do, like, fish for Lakers or go steelhead fishing or, you know, that kind of stuff. So that was one aspect of the book that was kind of fun. And I think, you know, this book, I got to use a lot more vegetables and a lot of different techniques that I didn't necessarily use in the venison book. I'd say there's some recipes that are a little more elevated. I don't want to say fine dining, but, like, leaning that direction rather than leaning towards kind of the more simplistic venison approach we took to the venison book. So that was kind of fun to do. The food's just a lot more colorful. It's a lot brighter. As you might imagine, a fish book might be, you know, you're using a lighter, leaner protein, so your flavors will naturally kind of end up that way.
All freshwater, right?
Yeah. It's all freshwater, and then there's some crayfish recipes. And then we narrowed it down, I think, I'm going to say it wrong, but we have salmon, trout, walleye, northerns, bluegill, perch, crappies, whitefish, crawdads, muskie, and catfish. Those are the 10 we ended up going with. And the way we laid it out, which is a little confusing, I'm still a little confused by it, but I couldn't figure out a better way to do it. We grouped it into a salmon and trout recipe. So basically, if you have salmon or trout, we think, you know, those were close enough flavor profiles that the recipes match well together. Then we have northerns and walleyes. Mm-hmm. And kind of the same deal, like, mm-hmm. those, you could kind of use those fish, swap them out for each other, and it doesn't matter. And then there's, like, a perch, crappie, bluegill section with that same idea. And then the last section was the whitefish, crawdads, muskie, and catfish.
Catch-all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you don't swap crawfish for muskie. That's not...
Right.
And then there's also in the book, which was kind of fun, there's a couple people from around town who joined in and gave recipes. So Jack Riebel from the Lexington came over, did his walleye sausage, which... Have you guys had the walleye
sausage? No.
Awesome. It's incredible.
Walleye sausage.
It's better than a lobster roll. The thing is
so
crazy.
He did catfish sausage at the Butcher in the Boar when he was there. And that was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Sort of a boudin. Catfish boudin, I guess it was.
It's probably it's probably super similar.
It was phenomenal.
That's crazy. That just sounds really good.
Texturally it's awesome, and just the flavors are so light, and, like, the sausage just kind of, like, falls. I mean, it's just like a really light, airy, perfect-tasting piece of fish. So that was a fun recipe to see. Then I have a friend, Eric Sather, over at Lowry Hill Meats. He came to do a recipe. Ia Vang did one. And I know I'm missing someone, and they're going to be mad, but it was fun just to bring those guys in and see what they wanted to do for recipes, and then, you know, have my own twist to it, too. So that's kind of the book in a nutshell.
So what have you got? So I'm going to be heading to Woodland Caribou in Canada, a provincial park up there similar to Boundary Waters type place, canoe-only type of park area here in a few weeks. And we're going to be going for lake trout. And so let's talk a little bit about that in terms of, you know, as opposed to the pike walleye grouping, the panfish grouping, and the other. Like, to me, I think that's great in terms of the trout, salmon. Obviously, that makes sense in terms of that type of fish. So what do you like to do in terms of cooking prep for those? For those fish, and do you have a favorite recipe out of the book?
Do you mean for lake?
For your trout salmon category, if you will, and it could be lake trout specifically.
Yeah,
if you want to.
I think the first recipe. Oh, that's not the book. That's a venison. I got it on here. I think the first recipe we did for the entire book was one of my favorites, and we did a wild rice stuffed whole lake trout. So you cook wild rice separately, take a lake trout. Stuff it, you know, with the wild rice, wrap it in twine, bake it off. And then once it's done, you pull, you know, you pull the wild rice out of the center of the, out of the trout, plate it with a little bit of flaked, trout. And then we did like an asparagus salad and a really light, bright beurre blanc on top of it. And it was like, this just, you know, I mean, that's a heavy prep one. There's a lot of ingredients that go into that, but that's just like, it was like a perfect way to, I don't know, just use that fish in a different way. And,
I've done something similar to that before with big trout, and I love it in terms of I've grilled with stuffed them with wild rice and done a twine around it. I just love it in terms of presentation and everything, and just showing people it isn't just, again, back to that aspect of just deep fried, you know, filet that that you've gotten on shore lunch or wherever.
Yeah,
it's not to say there's anything wrong with deep frying.
Absolutely, I eat it a lot.
even in the deep fried category, there are different ways of doing that. You know, if you take your wild rice and you pop it, and then mortar and pestle it into a flour, and dust your fish with a wild rice breading instead.
Ooh, I like that sound of that. I've never done
coming
that.
Soon.
Yeah, there we go. All right.
No.
So, I mean, there's just so many possibilities, but I think we've all gotten stuck because grandma only used to make, you know, saltine crackers, egg wash flour, and Hellman's starter sauce. You bring anything other than Hellman's, leave. Okay.
It's a sin.
It is. But no, it's just once you get outside of that, it's so many things are delicious, but you got to be willing to try.
And on the whole, like just doing the whole fish thing, you mentioned the presentation. It is a stunning presentation. You get to see this beautiful fish, but it's also just it's easier to do because you don't have to like break the fish down into little sections, you just stick a whole fish in the oven that's stuffed with wild rice. It's really a simple, you know, if you take out the beurre blanc, it's really a simple thing to create.
You know,
sounds like something you could do in the Boundary Waters.
Yeah,
you know, easy enough. It might, you know, take a little bit of time, but. You know,
you bring up a really good point. I think I'm going to bring some wild rice along up to Canada. I'm going to try that exactly.
I mean, a beurre blanc wouldn't be too difficult to do over a campfire, but, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm that skilled.
Just dip it in butter.
Squeeze a lemon and drench it in butter. You're good to go.
You know, that is the one thing that I do like about trout in terms of when I was a kid, you know, we had a small stream near the town where I grew up, and we would go with my dad, and we'd dunk crawlers in there, and with big long, you know, telescoping rods. We weren't fly fishing that much just because he knew that as kids it was too much. But we'd catch these small little rainbows and little brookies, and the aspect of just having that presented on the plate as the whole fish rather than this. You know, again, breaded item. Well, that changed
something
things.
Turned off.
That's much quieter now. It just connects you that much more to the experience of fishing, and you can go all in on it if you fry them up. You know, we would fry them up in the pan with just a light coating of flour and eat the tails, eat the head, eat it all.
Yeah,
you know, and it's great.
It's just, you know, I think there's something to be said that just with keeping flavor intact, too, when you cook a whole fish or anything, like the less you do it, the more flavor you're going to ultimately get out of it. That's kind of, it's something I've always thought and I've always tried to play off of. But, there's just something to cooking whole animals rather than trying to dice them up and make them look like something they're not.
Why would it be any different than a deer? You know, leave the bones in, you're going to get more flavor.
Well, I think there's an aspect of, you know, I think I've talked about this with both you guys over the years, of there's an aspect of familiarity that's good for introducing people to wild game. However, I do think, you know, we need to be adventurous and try new things. And I know, Jamie, you've got some thoughts on that relative to, you know, putting some recipes out there. And I think a lot of times people get caught in the tradition of, well, that's the way we always cook it. And I think one of the things that's important and I think is fun is trying something new. And I for one am a person where it takes time. Like I want to do it right, and I have to think about it. And I oftentimes find myself just going to the standby. You know, I've always prepared it that way, so it's easy to do. If I pull out some venison chops, or I'm going to pull out some trout, or what have you. But I think it's good to challenge yourself and try something new and have some fun with it. And that's where I think your books are really great in terms of, like I said, with that split pea neck, venison neck roast. That was a great one where I'm like, okay, I've never made this before, but I'm going to, you know, I want to try something a little different.
Yeah. And the book, I'd say the venison book especially, or I'd say both books, they're not, when I was writing them, I didn't intend them to be like a exact guide to cooking. They're just supposed to be kind of a, like, get you pointed in the right direction, and then use the technique, use some of the flavors, put in something else you might like, and kind of run with it. Because, you know, experimenting in the kitchen is half the fun of it, and you'll probably come up with something better than I did. So
I know I've done that before with some of your recipes in there, and that's generally something I do, which is so funny because my wife, she is a recipe follower. If it says 1.5 teaspoons, it is 1.5 teaspoons. And it's, if that is at this step in the process, and I'll just sort of, you know, just a little free form, just go with this. Yeah. I don't have that. Let's try something a little different. And yeah, it's obviously just two different ways of looking at it, but that's the way I'm able to find it approachable and with the ingredients I got in the kitchen. And I think that's great, like you said, to give people the bandwidth and the authority, if you will, to say, hey, if you don't have that cut, try a different cut. Yep. If you don't have that ingredient, try a different ingredient. Experiment. Try something new.
Yeah. And, yeah, hopefully I give people the tools in both these books to just have a jumping off point and then let them dig in themselves.
Yeah, so. Yeah, absolutely. Let's go a different path for a second and talk about quality meats from a butcher shop.
Yeah.
So you mentioned a little bit ago, I know your buddy Eric has got Lowry Hill Meats. I love going into some of these new butcher shops that are like old traditional butcher shops in terms of what they're doing. So talk a little bit about that and what your thoughts are on that and what they're doing up there, I guess.
Yeah, Lowry Hill, I mean, it's a great spot. They do, they go through, I think it's like one or two cows a week and probably 6-7 hogs, and they do their own lamb and all that stuff. But it's pretty fun because you walk into the shop like that, and instead of having this like expectation of, I'm going to get 4 pounds of tenderloin so I can roast tenderloin, you go into the butcher shop, see what they took out of an animal that week, see what's left in the case, and it might not be a cut you've ever seen or ever heard of. But then you have Eric there or any of the other butchers who are all great resource points, and they can point you in a direction with that cut of meat to do a new recipe that you might not have been expecting to when you walked into the shop. So it's pretty cool from that standpoint. And just watching those guys like saw through entire animals every single week, it's pretty cool. Not a lot of people do that anymore. You know, a lot of things come vacuum sealed, you know, in little pre-portioned pieces, and you miss out on a lot of the good chunks that way.
Are they sourcing at specific places, or are they like, you know, the local and or grass fed and or all of those things, you know, that are discussed a lot?
Yeah, so they do. I know they do. They get these really great hogs from Pork and Plants in southern Minnesota. They do a couple different hogs. So Pork and Plants hogs are redwattle hogs. They just have these humongous fat caps on them. I mean, just giant. So if you're into that, you might get a red wattle hog. But then I know they get some leaner hogs from other places. And if you're into that, then you have, like, you know, a different type of hog to choose from. And then I know their beef, you know, I don't know if they're 100% grass-fed, but they do grass-fed and probably corn finish sort of thing. And it's all Midwestern raised. So you know you're going in there, you're getting a nice cut of meat cut by a guy probably that morning. And yeah, great spot. And they have really good sandwiches too, which they just turn all their meat that they butcher into sandwiches. So whatever you get in there, you're doing something right.
Awesome. So you guys got any cool trips coming up? Anything, or it doesn't have to be cool, anything you're interested in?
Are we off fish?
Or can I go back? Because I got questions.
Yeah. Go back to fish, man. Go back to fish.
So you mentioned muskie.
Yeah.
And not a common fish to eat.
No.
I don't know anybody who has.
Okay.
I've never eaten a muskie. I've never, well, I caught one, but it was tiny.
I've never caught.
Yeah. No, it was like 12 pounds, and I was Lindy Rig fishing off the end of a dock.
So you're not intending to catch a muskie.
I was not intending to catch a muskie. So what would you do with a muskie?
So I think there's a little more to talk over on that. So in Minnesota, where we are right now, I think the size limit is like, I think it's like 54 inches to keep a muskie here. I don't know the number.
Depending on what kind. The tiger muskies, yes, it's 40. Yeah. Certain lakes, it's 48, yeah, 54 yeah, in the north. Yeah.
It's something like that. It's a little more extreme in Minnesota. We don't fish to keep anything. We don't fish to keep muskies in the first place.
Right.
But particularly not in Minnesota. We do most of our fishing in northern Wisconsin. Muskie fishing, where I have a cabin, and I have a few friends who have cabins. And I've only kept 3 muskies in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first two were, they were going to die. It was just kind of the responsible thing. We typically don't go out to keep a muskie. The muskie we actually caught for this book was 41 inches. And in Wisconsin, you keep anything over 40. And it also looked like it had a broken spine, that at some point it had broken its spine and healed.
And it healed.
And it also looked like it had just gotten attacked. Like, if you, there's a picture of the muskie in the book, but you can see it, and it looks like it's seen better days. So we brought in a 41, 42-inch muskie that looked like it'd seen better days, and it was like the perfect fish to keep for the book. But it's not a regular, it's just not a regular thing. I told one guy over at the fish guys that I kept the muskie and put it in a cookbook, and
he got a little upset.
I thought he was going to cry. He didn't like that at all. But then, so in the book, I think we did 3 recipes for it. We did a pickled muskie. We did muskie nuggets, which were my favorite. We basically just took muskie, dusted them in a rub, and then cooked it over an open fire, and then poured like an herb sauce over it, and they were delicious. And then, we did a muskie and mussel stew, which was really good too. But muskie, it's a little bit, if you cook it way too far, it gets really like kind of mushy, and it just kind of, it's kind of dry in your mouth. But if you cook it just right, it has a ton of texture, it has a ton of flavor.
Pretty similar to northern pike?
Yeah, but a little more down the spectrum.
Okay.
And just in general qualities. But again, you know, I've only cooked 3 of them in my life.
Yeah.
So I don't have a huge sample size to pick from. But in northern Wisconsin, there's people who at least in where my cottage is, there's people who catch them and keep them all the time, and they swear by them. Yeah. You'll see a lot of people smoke them up there.
So after muskie, then, because this year I'm dedicating a lot of time to catching a muskie.
Okay.
I've decided I need to. After muskie.
It's a big decision.
Oh, I know. Because it's expensive.
Your life is over.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. And I've decided to do it on a fly. So it's going to be even a little bit more difficult.
So it's called the fish of 1,000 casts. When you're doing a fly, I don't even know what number you'd have to go up to.
I don't know.
Times it by time.
Yeah,
for
right,
sure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
In Minnesota, the northern pike is my favorite fish. I'm almost anti-walleye. Just because, but the northern pike is my favorite. How are you preparing northern pike, and what is your favorite way?
Yeah, I love pike too. It's a good, clean tasting fish that I just think, when we were growing up, we didn't keep them. My dad didn't keep them, or I didn't keep them either, I guess. I think just because they were hard to clean and no one really knew how to clean them. I finally learned how to clean them when the lake that our cabin was on got pretty, the northern population just took off. So we were starting to catch northerns left and right.
Little hammer handles all over.
Yeah, all over the place. So I just learned how to fillet them. And now I have an easier time filleting a northern than I do anything else.
Are you Y-boning them or the five fillet technique?
Five fillet technique, which is what we call it in the book.
Yeah.
And it's super simple.
Yeah.
It is simple.
It's so easy. Yeah. And then Yeah, so I'm trying to think through recipes that were in the book. I should open it up, but, you know, like a classic kind of French way I learned how to cook pike, or we would use walleye in New York, but it was basically making, like, it's called a quenelle, which is a fancy way to say a really tasty meatball. But you basically blend it with some eggs and some other stuff, like some cream, and I'd have to look at the recipe. And then you shape them in spoons. It forms like almost like a sausage consistency. You shape them. You shape little quenelles or little meatballs in spoons, and then you dip it in boiling salted water to cook, and you ended up with that light fish meatball. And then we took those quenelles, and in the book we put them into like a watercress soup, so a springtime watercress soup. And you just get this really bright, kind of peppery watercress soup matched up against this light, airy fish flavor. And then there's a squeeze of lime on it, some fresh herbs. And that's probably my favorite northern recipe.
That sounds so good.
I've done the quenelles and then served it in a crawfish bisque.
Exactly, yeah. That's another way to do it. Yeah. That's
probably
the more traditional way to do it.
I've never done any of those, and that sounds good, and I'm definitely doing it this summer.
It's so easy to do, too.
So with the five fillet technique, where you cut down, take the back off, and then you bring out that little strip in the middle, I don't know that you call them tenderloins, but that's kind of what they are, right?
Yeah.
So you end up with these little strips, but, you know, however long, big your fish is. Magnus Nilsson, a chef out of Sweden, does a thing with king crab and almost burnt cream, where he then just, in a dry pan, sears them, sprays them with a little wood vinegar, and then serves it with the almost burnt cream. So I've done that with the pike loins there. And it tastes, I know it's a ridiculous statement, but poor man's lobster.
It tastes. Oh, 100% believe it, yeah.
And I mean, the poor man's lobster thing is sort of a I don't know what you'd call it, obsession of mine. I've heard so many people tell me about some ridiculous method of cooking something and it tastes just like lobster. So I've been working my way through all of them. You know, I work at the VA as a nurse, took care of an old man who was telling me, you take your pike fillets and soak them in white vinegar for 24 hours and then boil them in Sprite and serve them with drawn butter. And it tastes just like lobster.
Is that a real thing?
That's what he said. Yes. That's something he says you have to do. So I was like, I'm going to try that. And I went home and I took two pike fillets and I soaked them for 24 hours in vinegar. And then I boiled them in 7-Up and served them with butter. Problem is, I couldn't get them out of the pan because I didn't have a strainer that would strain it out. It just turned to mush.
Yeah.
It was just like this liquid fish.
So that wasn't the technique. No, is that what you're saying?
Well, come on. Corn syrup sweetened pot? That's the best ingredient to have.
But that's not even like the most ridiculous thing I've heard. You know, the people that take sheep's head and boil them in Mountain Dew and serve them with butter. And, I mean, pick a fish. There's somebody out there who says it tastes just like lobster. And, you know, here in Minnesota, we've got our eel pout that everybody claims tastes just like lobster.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. Well, I haven't eaten eel pout yet, but, you know, that's getting a lot of attention recently.
And it is. I just read an article about them wanting to transfer it from trash fish to a sport fish and putting a limit on them and making it harder for people to keep them.
Interesting.
Yeah, because they are. They're a delicious fish. I've had zero problems eating them in the past.
Had this idea for a fishing show a few years ago. We trotted it out to a few different places called Junk Fish. And basically, we'd take a couple of guys that we had where we'd just go around the world and whatever culture called their trash fish or their junk fish, we just go out and fish them, cook them
up. I already see a problem with your show.
Yeah.
You go everywhere else in the world, there's no such thing as junk fish. There's just
no,
fish.
There is.
We're the only ones that really, like, oh, I would never eat that. Carp is the most eaten fish in the world.
You guys ever eaten escalar?
It's a great fish.
It's a phenomenal fish.
I don't know that I've ever
had it. It's so good. It's so good. But it is, be careful if you have the certain gene. it's not going to agree with you, and you're going to be running to the bathroom.
Well, it has a super high fat content. Oh.
It's like crazy how high that fat. It tastes like it tastes right out of the fish. Eat it sushi style, nigiri. It tastes like it's in drawn butter.
Yeah.
Practically, it's amazing.
It's delicious.
Yeah,
I think there's like a. I think when I used to eat a lot more than I do right now. Eat a lot of barbecue right now, but there's like a 6 ounce maximum you're supposed to have. If you eat more than 6 ounces, you're setting yourself up for failure, kind of thing. To all the listeners out there, so that's my word
of
warning.
Be careful. Okay, so back to my question. I had mentioned, in about, I think, where are we at here, early April, so in about 6-8 weeks time, I'll be up in Woodland Caribou going after lake trout, maybe some walleyes, into this region I've never been before. My brother and my nephew have gone to this place, this area of Canada several times, so I'm looking forward to it. You guys have any hunting trips planned for this coming fall? You have anything planned for a fishing trip this summer?
My focus is mainly on the business right now, so
yeah.
The only thing I really won't miss is turkey season. That's my favorite season. So turkey season's a couple weeks away, and that's, you know, we'll go to turkey camp for 4 or 5 days, and that'll be it for me. I think I'd like to do my September. I have an uncle who lives in Alaska, and we try to go moose hunting annually. Just don't know if that's going to happen this year. So, how about you?
The end of the month, I've got 6 days. We're going down southeast Minnesota trout fishing, and depending on the level of the water over on the Mississippi, we're going to swing back and try to do some catfish over there.
Oh, nice.
And then June, we're going up the North Shore, so we'll do some fishing. We've got turkey season coming. Foraging is coming.
Oh, yeah, foraging season.
I got mushrooms that I got to go get, ramps all over, nettles. I love nettles.
Yeah.
I pick tons of them and then just puree it all and freeze it in ice cube trays.
Yep.
So that I can make pastas all throughout the year with my nettles.
Easy to find too.
Yeah,
they're not a hard one to forage.
And you know, if you knock on a farmer's door and you tell him, hey, I'd like to pick all those nettles over there, you're like, yeah,
have at it. You might get a place to hunt
fall
too.
Yeah.
I think the first statement they say is, what's wrong with you?
Exactly. Yeah, no, everybody wants to know what's wrong. You can't eat those. And that's bad. No, it's not. This fall, I've got a week in the boundary waters again, deer hunting. But that might change depending on whether or not I get drawn for a bear license this year, and then I'll be bear hunting instead. But
you got bad problem or good problems to have.
Yeah, exactly. It sounds like a very good problem. You got a lot of trips coming up. That's good.
Yep. And then November, I've got a week. I'm still not sure what I want to do yet. I'm tossing around the idea of trying to put together an archery hunt and pheasant hunt in South Dakota, or I might just go back up north, walk trails all day for grouse, and sit in a stand at night. And
sounds like heaven.
Yeah,
sounds pretty good.
Okay, so you got another trip in November?
November, it depends. I might go to South Dakota, try to do a pheasant archery deer. Otherwise, I'll go up north and do the grouse and deer. So, assuming I don't get a deer before then.
So you're going to go after pheasants with your bow. Is that what you said in South Dakota?
Possibly.
Yeah.
There might be a trip to Arizona as well in September for doves. So,
I have never gone dove hunting. Have you ever gone dove hunting?
No, and I'd love to. That's one I've always wanted to do.
Yeah. Let me know. My dad lives in Yuma, Arizona, which is like the dove hunting capital of the world.
Sweet.
So he's been trying to get me down there for years, and it's now time I need to go down there. So,
well, I think a trip needs to be planned.
Yep. And then Mom just bought 6 acres over in Tucson, and she's got javelina all over the place. So
there you go. Man. There you go.
I got to live your life.
Yeah, sure.
Jeez. Do a swap for a week and see how it goes.
Yeah, his business will go bankrupt and he'll never come back.
Yeah. I don't think I could handle working in a hospital either. I don't think I could do a day.
If I told you what I did, you wouldn't like it.
Yeah, well, my girlfriend brings home stories and it's... It's tough work. I can't believe the things that she does on a daily basis. It's nuts.
I couldn't do it either. No, it would be tough. Fortunately, we got you guys.
Yep.
Well, hey, I appreciate you guys taking some time to sit down, and awesome that Matt, Casey, and the rest of the crew here let us sit in the brewery here in the day they're closed, and check out John Whipfley's Fish Cookbook coming out on May 15th.
Apparently May 14th.
Yeah.
We just found out.
Right.
So it'll be out one day.
It'll be out soon.
Sooner than later.
But check it out. And if you are in the Twin Cities, come on over and check out his food truck and his barbecue. Got anything interesting coming up this summer? You're just going to be throwing out the meat as much as you can.
Slinging a bunch of meat is what we call it. But yeah. We're going to be doing, we do daily or not, we kind of do weekly or monthly specials. We're going to start doing beef cheeks this week, which I'm excited about. And we mix it up too. But we don't have like pork shoulder. We do like pork belly instead of pork shoulder. Our ribs are a big focus. We have a really good sausage that Lowry Hill Meats makes for us, our recipe. And then we try and use the farmer's market when farmer's market season comes around to do all the sides and stuff like that. So there's always something new rolling out of the trailer.
Awesome.
That's kind of it.
Awesome. Well, check it out. And thanks a lot, you guys.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Well, everyone, that is it for today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with John Whipfley and Jamie Carlson. If you get a chance, check out the recipes for nettle pasta and venison heart tartare that Jamie has posted recently at modcarn.com, as well as John Whipfley's fish cookbook. It can be found at amazon.com. is probably the easiest way to check it out, and I guarantee you won't be dissatisfied, and you'll really probably find some fun new ways to prepare fish.
Thanks for listening to the Modern Carnivore Podcast. You can continue the journey by going to modcarn.com.
Thanks for listening to the Modern Carnivore Podcast. You can continue the journey by going to modcarn.com.